regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
185,000 pages.
Now, public accountability and transparency, there will be no public support.
Is this really the best we can do?
If there's a regulation that doesn't make any sense, why do you keep...
Do you know who wrote the regulatory laws you must comply with?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's webinar. This afternoon, January 20th, we discuss a litigation update investigating Title VI and Title IX complaints. My name is Evelyn Hildebrand, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. I'll introduce our moderator, Mr. Devin Westhill, very briefly, and he will introduce our speaker for this afternoon. Devin is the president and general counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity, and he previously worked as a top civil rights official at the United States Department of Agriculture under President Trump. Devin is a member of the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group Executive Committee, and we're delighted to welcome him this afternoon as our moderator. After our speaker gives opening remarks, we will turn to audience questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. And we will handle questions as we can towards the end of the program this afternoon. Again, it's the Q&A tab at the bottom of your screen. With that, thank you for being with us today. Devin, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Evelyn. And thank you to the audience for being here. I think we're going to have a really interesting hour here if we go that long. I think we will. I hope we will. And thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting another really fantastic program and inviting me to moderate here. Today is the anniversary of the inauguration of the Biden-Harris administration. And I think it's a good time to take stock of some of what the Biden-Harris administration has been doing as it pertains to civil rights law. To some extent, this anniversary, which was marked by the president's rare press conference yesterday, is a bit ignominious. We've seen over the course of the last year a slew of race-based initiatives, from farm loan relief to FDA guidance recently on rationing COVID treatment based on race. And we've seen some other areas where it appears as though civil rights laws in this country are being selectively enforced, among other issues. Today is not so much a litigation update as it is an update on civil rights advocacy of a one-man wrecking crew. A little bit of background on what we'll talk about today. Title IX bars sex discrimination, and Title VI bars race discrimination in federally funded education programs and activities. What we'll talk about today are single-sex, female-only, also male-only programs, scholarships, awards, fellowships, camps, clubs, et cetera, that appear to violate Title IX in colleges and universities, and also perhaps some of those programs and scholarships, et cetera, that are for only people of color that will invoke Title VI concerns. We thought perhaps at the beginning of the Biden administration that this administration would be very strong on ensuring an discrimination-free educational environment for all. In fact, early in the Biden administration, there was an executive order on guaranteeing an educational environment free of discrimination on the basis of sex, including sexual orientation or gender identity. And even the Secretary of the Department of Education, Secretary Cardona, indicated that one of the things that would be very important for his department was to ensure the right to equal access to educational opportunities free from sex discrimination. The guest that we have on today to discuss this topic contends that maybe things have significantly changed since the beginning of the Biden administration, when these statements were made, when this executive order was signed, and perhaps it's making it more difficult to file complaints. And we'll hear more about that here in just a second. Our speaker today, Mark Perry, I think Professor Perry is the person at the Department of Education who has filed more complaints, you know, in this regard than anyone else in the history of the Department of Education. He'll correct me if I'm wrong about that. He's also perhaps better and more affectionately known to college administrators who allow these civil rights violations on their campuses as a giant thorn in their sides. Professor Perry is concurrently a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Michigan. He's very well known as the creator and editor of the popular economics blog Carpe Diem. At AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, Professor Perry writes about economic and financial issues for American.com and the AE Ideas blog. Professor Perry taught economics for a long period of time, ending at the University of Michigan, but starting his career in the early 90s at George Mason University. And I'm calling in or phone webinaring in from Jacksonville. At one time, he's a professor there at Jacksonville University. Go Dolphins. Now he is calling in from Ponte Vedra. We encourage more people to come down to Florida for leisure and business. Professor Perry has an MBA in finance from the University of Minnesota, a master's degree, and a PhD in economics from George Mason University. At the tail end of his remarks, we will, as usual, have a question and answer period. Please be thinking about any questions you have for Professor Perry. Maybe not typical of Federalist Society programs. You don't necessarily have to have a question mark at the end of your remarks in the question and answer segment. And we also just want to hear some ideas or approaches one might consider to address these issues on today's webinar, rather than with the one-off complaints that Professor Perry is very well known for. Perhaps lawsuits. What can we do to address this issue in Congress or in the state legislatures? Any other tips that you might have or thoughts? We certainly want I hear those, so don't necessarily have to be questions, but we certainly do welcome questions. With that, I'm going to stop talking and turn the mic over to Professor Perry to hear what he has to say. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Devin. I'll talk for hopefully about 30 minutes and then save the rest of the time for Q&A and comments. I thought I would start by kind of going through the background of how I got started on this one-man mission or one-man crusade to challenge the systemic sexism and racism in higher education and the double standard or selective standard for enforcing Title IX. And it really started back in 2016 when I became aware that Michigan State University was operating a women-only lounge in the Michigan State University Student Union. And I had been in Flint, Michigan for about 20 years at that time, teaching at the University of Michigan in Flint, and it was about 50 miles away from Michigan State. And I went over, I really couldn't believe that a university was still engaged in what I described as gender apartheid, where they were had this, segregated campus space. And I visited the Michigan State Union, and it's in the center of campus, this large building. And when you walk in the main entrance, the entire wing of the first floor was set aside as a sex-segregated women-only lounge. There was this plaque on the wall that said it had been there since 1925, so almost 100 years, and it survived without ever being challenged, I guess, until I brought a civil rights complaint against Michigan State. And I guess the history was there originally was a men's only lounge in the up until the 1960s, and that got converted into some other type of space. So I found this objectionable for many reasons that motivated this kind of one-man mission that I've been on now for almost 6 years. And first, I felt for sure that that just had to be illegal. And it turns out it was a federal violation of Title IX. But at the time, I didn't know how to file a Title IX complaint with the Office for Civil Rights. I knew that it also had to be a violation of state civil rights laws, which it was. And then actually in Michigan, it was also a violation of the state constitution, which was amended in 2006 by a voter referendum that prohibits preferential treatment and discrimination on the basis of sex at public universities in Michigan. And then, of course, Michigan State University, like all universities, has this very strong statement of non-discrimination that they prohibit and will not allow any discrimination on the basis of race, sex, gender identity, and so on. then I thought it was also, I found it objectionable because I just thought it was morally and ethically unacceptable, and, you know, aside from the legal concept, the legal issues, but it was just unacceptable for a university to show such blatant favoritism and allow such strong preferences on the basis of sex in a public space, in a public building. And then also it was in, you know, direct contradiction to the holy trinity of today's higher education's leftist wokeism of diversity, inclusion, and equity. I like that order because then it's DI for short. So the women-only lounge was exactly the opposite. So instead of promoting diversity, it was promoting uniformity. It wasn't inclusive. It was practicing exclusion, and it wasn't promoting equity. It was promoting inequity. And universities, as you know today, invest heavily in DIE. I'm not sure exactly about MSU, but I've documented that the University of Michigan and Ohio State University both have more than 125 diversocrats, I call them. And those are staff members with the words either diversity, inclusion, or equity in their job title, including dozens of Title IX officers and staff members. And so the Title IX staff at Michigan State, you know, supposed to ensure that Title IX and Title VI are being actively enforced, as the university regularly certifies to the Department of Education as a condition of receiving federal or really taxpayer funds. And yet that doesn't happen. And so over the last 5 years or so, I've uncovered actually more than 1,200 Title IX and Title VI violations at 400 colleges and universities, starting with Michigan State, which I think demonstrates that most universities are really not taking their Title IX and Title VI obligations seriously. And then I came to realize that the Michigan State Women-Only Lounge was a physically symbolic, visible representation of what I think is systemic sexism throughout all of higher education, but usually less visible and less obvious and harder to detect in a segregated physical space on a college campus. In fact, I would say, give me 10 to 15 minutes on almost any college or university's website, and I can almost uncover at least one program that violates Title IX or Title VI. And so that's what motivated me, was to expose this systemic sexism and double standard in higher education for enforcing federal civil rights, you know, selectively, enabled often by an OCR that is frequently willing to allow universities to violate Title IX or Title VI, or fail to enforce Title IX and Title VI, or support devious ways to allow universities to continue to discriminate on the basis of race and sex. I'll talk about that in a minute. So it's the double standard in higher education, that Title IX and Title VI are only enforced selectively for the preferred groups, which today are women and BIPOCs, or Blacks, Indigenous persons of color, while those same civil rights laws are not enforced for the unpreferred groups, which are men, whites, and Asians. Another reason I found the MSU Women-Only Lounge to be objectionable, along with the thousands of other Title IX violations that allow female favoritism, is that I think that they're totally unnecessary today. And if I can switch over here and share the screen here and go to this PowerPoint slide here. Okay, so this is showing the historical pattern of fall enrollment in colleges and university in the U.S. back to 1960. So you can see here that when Title IX was passed in 1972, 57% of college students were male and 43% were female. And then by 1979, 7 years after Title IX was passed, and the pattern was in place, I think would have happened even without Title IX, but by 1979, women outnumbered men for being enrolled in U.S. colleges and universities. And by 2003, the pattern was completely reversed. So whereas there used to be 57% males in 1972, now by 2003, there were 57% of college students enrolled were female. And then this was reflected in the, go to the next slide. Okay, and then that was reflected in the imbalance in college degrees. And this is showing the share of all college degrees, associates, bachelor's, master's, and doctor's degrees, that when Title IX was passed in 1972, 59% of college graduates were male and only 41% female. And by 1982, women outnumbered men for earning college degrees. And by 2007, the pattern completely reversed. And now it's 59% of college degrees were going to women and only 41% to men. And that then kind of stabilized. And that's kind of about where we're at today. And then this is showing the last year's class of 2021, the huge gender imbalance in favor of women for associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's and doctor's degrees. And then for all degrees, again, it's about 59% female, 41% male. And that means that last year, for every 100 males who graduated from a U.S. university with a degree, there was 143 females. And the imbalance was even greater for master's degrees, 154 women for every 100 men and 157 women for associate's degrees for every 100 men. And then in terms of the cumulative effect of this gender imbalance, this is showing the cumulative college degree gap in favor of women. And so since women started earning a majority of degrees in the early 80s, women now over the last almost 40 years have earned 15 million more college degrees than men at all levels and almost 7 million more bachelor's degrees than men. So this then, let's see, did that go away now? Yeah. Okay, there we go. All right. So, you know, I think if the goal of Title IX was gender parity in sports and gender parity in educational programs and outcomes, but that was really reached 40 years ago in the early 80s. And so that really men have been an underrepresented minority for the last 40 years. But, you know, it seems like parity was never enough because that was achieved 40 years ago. And so now it's really more about privilege and power and preferences and payback than parity. And so I think that the widespread systemic sexism that's reflected in Title IX violations is based on this outdated and false narrative that might describe the 1950s, but certainly not today's reality. And that false narrative is that women are still marginalized or victimized or oppressed, and they face challenges, obstacles, and discrimination in higher education that justifies, you know, favoritism, special preferences, and a hugely disproportionate share of campus resources that aren't available for men in the form of women's lounges, at least until recently, but then scholarships, fellowships, awards, mentoring, tutoring, special orientations, industry meetings, summer programs, summer camps, coding clubs, leadership programs, entrepreneurship programs, et cetera, that operate exclusively for women or primarily for women while illegally excluding and discriminating against boys and men in violation of Title IX. So that's the background of my objections to MSU's gender apartheid and the female favoritism and illegal discrimination that motivated my first civil rights complaint. And at the time, I didn't know how to file with OCR, so I filed a sex discrimination complaint with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights and then had several interviews with their attorneys, and they were trying to determine whether or not I needed legal standing to proceed and whether I'd have to actually go to the lounge and be asked to leave. But in the process of during the evaluation, I leaked the story to some media contacts, and it kind of snowballed and got local coverage in Michigan and national coverage, including a story in the Washington Post. So then in the summer of 2016, Michigan State kind of quietly closed down the lounge for remodeling, which I think was really for political purposes because they wouldn't have been able to just take the sign off the wall in the fall and then say, hey, the space is still there, but it's now open to all students. So they had to reconfigure it. And they remodeled it. I think they added a men's bathroom or something. And then and they reopened it in the fall to protest and sit-ins and demonstrations and a petition from the women on campus who were very upset about losing their female-only space. But I think it illustrates an example of an insight from Thomas Sowell, who said that when people get used to preferential treatment, then equal treatment to them seems like discrimination. So it seems like the women felt now they were being discriminated against, but they were really just being treated equally with their male counterparts. But, you know, by that time, it was too late. Michigan State couldn't justify this ongoing Title IX violation any longer. It had other Title IX issues pending, including the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal that resulted in Michigan State paying a record $4.5 million fine just a few years later. And even though Michigan State, now they kind of claimed that they were already considering converting the women's lounge, I was sure that the national attention about at least my pending civil rights complaint helped motivate them to make the change as soon as possible. So then, you know, having a major Big Ten university correct a long-standing Title IX violation, at least partly due to my efforts, motivated me to continue challenging violations at other schools. And so then my kind of Title IX antenna was up and I started looking for more violations. And I didn't have to wait very long because then in early 2017, I got the annual email from my provost that I'd been receiving every year for 20 years about the 11 faculty awards that at UMM Flint that include, you know, a cash stipend plus some teaching time release. So it's a valuable award because you get money plus less work. And of the 11 faculty awards, I was only eligible for 6 because 3 were for female faculty only and 2 were for minority faculty only. So now I did have legal standing, filed another complaint then with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, which informed the University of Michigan they were under investigation. And then I was contacted by the Title IX director in Ann Arbor and asked if I would drop the complaint if they changed the awards. And I agreed. And so then now all 5 awards were then open to all faculty. And so it was another kind of civil rights victory. And then shortly after that, in the mail, I got a email from, I guess, the provost again, or somebody, one of the administrators, that the University of Michigan in Flint was introducing this new summer STEM camp called GEMS, Girls in Engineering, Math, and Science, but it was for girls only in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And they were distributing the flyers and asking for, you know, recommendations for applications. And so that was clearly illegal. And I complained then to the Title IX director, and the program was quickly changed from girl only into, you know, a new program that's open now to all genders. But when I thought about how that happened and that the process would have been for a new program, that it would have been originally, you know, proposed by some of the science faculty who would have had to get the approval of their departments and their department chairs for the program and the budget. Then it would have gone to the dean's office and the dean and associate dean and the assistant dean and the assistant dean to the associate dean, and all the deanlets would have had to see the proposal and sign off on it and approve it. And then it would have gone from the dean's office to the provost office, and the provost and associate provost and assistant provost and assistant provost to the associate provost, all of the at the provost level, they would have had to sign off on it. Then it would have gone to the chancellor, and then it got announced to the faculty. But I was just, you know, kind of astounded that so many university administrators, faculty, deans, provosts, chancellors had seen that proposal, and not one of them, I guess, had even questioned whether or not that was illegal. And it got all the way to the point that it was then being marketed and promoted as a single-sex program, completely in violation of Title IX. So then that illustrated to me the unawareness of Title IX in higher education, or the unconcern about violating Title IX when the discrimination is against non-females. So college administrators are either, you know, unaware of federal civil rights laws, or they know they're violating Title IX, but they think they're above the law. And so I think it's some combination of both an unawareness and a lack of concern about violating Title IX, especially because, you know, universities have violated Title IX with impunity for so many decades because they've never been legally challenged before. I just filed a Title IX complaint versus the University of Southern Florida for a women-only award program that has been around since 1988 and has never been challenged, I guess. And then even when challenged, then they face generally minimal consequences. There's no fines, penalties, apologies, admission of guilt, payments to victims. So I think there's a mentality in higher education often that we'll just violate Title IX for as long as we can to further our goals of whatever it is, social justice, and then we'll make corrections if and when we get caught. So then after that, another successful challenge at U of M Flint, I next targeted U of M Ann Arbor, where I found about 20 single-sex female-only programs and 30 female-only scholarships. And I filed an internal complaint with the Title IX office that was rejected without any explanation and without notifying me of any right to appeal, which I think now then illustrates the stubbornness of many universities to correct their Title IX violations. And so then they kind of stubbornly, you know, allow those violations and allow them to continue. But by that time, then with some of the media attention for my challenge at Michigan State, you know, I made a number of contacts, including some attorneys, and then I learned how to file Title IX complaints with OCR, which is actually, you know, a pretty easy process. You just send an email to the district office where the university is located, to the 12 regions, and say, you know, University X receives federal funding. They're required to enforce Title IX and Title VI. They're not. Here's the programs that are apparently in violation. Please investigate the university. So then since I filed my first Title IX complaint with the OCR versus the University of Michigan, that was in June of 2018. It was open for investigation in January 2019. So that's been 3 years now, and it's still open. And then since then, I've filed a total now as of this week of 402 Title IX or Title VI complaints for more than 1,200 violations. And based on those 400 complaints, about half of those have been opened so far by OCR for investigation. And then more than 100 of those investigations now have been resolved, mostly in my favor. And so then here's what I've kind of learned over the last 3 or 4 years about OCR and Title IX complaints, is that they, like a federal bureaucracy, OCR, as you would expect, generally operates kind of with snail-like efficiency, both in terms of evaluating complaints, which can sometimes take, you know, sometimes can take more than a year, and then in terms of investigations, which can take more than a year or 3 years now in the case of University of Michigan. You know, and as you know, Title IX is a very clear law. It's only 37 words, and the violations that I've reported are very clear violations, so it doesn't seem like it should really take that long. But I think often the length of the resolution of a investigation has to do with either the willingness or stubbornness of the university to correct their violations once they've been exposed. And I think maybe many of the universities, maybe if they're a little more honest or ethical, or they just want to end a federal civil rights investigation as soon as possible, they'll move pretty quickly to correct the violations, frequently according to OCR's, what they call their rapid resolution process. So if a university can make corrections during the beginning of an investigation, once they've been notified, then they can usually get the case resolved by having it technically dismissed by OCR, where OCR will say that they've determined that the actions that the university has taken are sufficient to resolve the complaint allegations and require no monitoring. So consistent with the case processing manual, OCR will dismiss a complaint if it obtains credible information during an investigation indicating that the complaint is currently resolved. So that's frequently what happens. If the complaint is not resolved with those voluntary corrections early in the investigation, then the OCR will take its time and will end its investigation then with a voluntary resolution agreement, which I think, you know, most universities know that they should try to avoid those, because then the OCR kind of dictates to the university how the violation will be resolved, or they'll have a couple different options to either discontinue the program or convert it from female only into coeducational. And then there's usually reporting requirements for a number of years. And then sometimes they have to have some remedial Title IX training for their staff who are involved in an application process. So I've had about 10 voluntary resolution agreements, which are the strongest type of correction and most desirable from my end. And they're usually signed by the president of the university, kind of, you know, signifying, you know, how important it is when there's a violation and then a correction. But most resolutions have been in the form of what OCR would call dismissals, when the university will either terminate its program or it opens the program to all genders, sometimes somewhat deceptively. So here's another part of my experience. Like, for example, Harvard has a one-week women's leadership initiative program that costs $13,000. And they clearly market it to women. And so I filed a Title IX complaint, and they made this one change that the OCR, you know, said was okay. And it's a kind of a legal fig leaf, I guess, or this, you know, disclaimer where now it says, while the program is focused on women and those who identify as women executives, the program is open to all executives who meet the admissions criteria, including all men, I guess, who want to study women's leadership. Then Stanford University has a similar program. All the top business schools have these very expensive women's leadership programs. Stanford has their executive program in women's leadership, and they clearly say that the program is designed for women 8 to 12 years into their careers. But then buried in small print at the bottom of the program website, and this was where the San Francisco OCR considered this to be an acceptable correction to their Title IX violation, it now says in small print, consistent with its non-discrimination policy, Stanford's programs are open to participants regardless of race, color, sex, gender identity, and so on. So it seems like they're allowing those kind of legal fig leaves as a correction, and the program we know is going to continue to operate for women only. Then there's also been this new coordinated effort just in the last year that, again, is, I think, tied to the change in administration. And it seems like there has been some national effort among the 12 regional OCR offices where they've shared some memo or come up with a way that they're going to try to combat the complaints that I've been filing. And there's some other individuals who are filing complaints now in an organization. So they're dealing with hundreds of complaints now. So then after the complaint gets filed, and maybe even after it gets open for investigation, then they'll send me an email and say something like, what they're actually asking for are names of actual victims, which they never used to do because, again, there's no legal standing requirement for an OCR complaint. But they'll say, do you have any evidence of any individual who, because of their sex, has been excluded from this program? If so, identify that person by name and the date of said exclusion and provide their contact information. So that's been very, very common. And then I've tried a number of different ways to try to respond to that in the last year. Most of them seems to be unsuccessful attempts to kind of respond. And so I've tried to make some valid legal arguments citing case law like Teamsters versus the United States, where the United States Supreme Court said that discrimination isn't limited to the direct language that people will see, like women only or women only, but it can include actual practices such as how an educational opportunity is publicized and promoted and the program's recruitment techniques, which are clearly targeted to a single sex. I've tried using, you know, kind of reason and logic and the reasonable person standard, suggesting that, you know, reasonable males are not going to waste their time in an exercise in futility. I mean, unless they're looking for legal standing, but they're not going to apply for a program for which they're clearly not qualified for. Many times, you know, there are time-consuming application materials that have to be submitted. You have to include some kind of statement of interest. You have to get letters of recommendation or provide references. If it's a research grant, you have to come up with a detailed budget. And then I've also suggested that if OCR, if they're interested in determining how many men or non-females have applied and been excluded from a female-only program, or accepted, that the burden should be on the university to provide those data, not the complainant who doesn't have access to university records. I've used the disparate treatment argument that even if men can join a women's leadership program to study women's leadership, it's illegal disparate treatment under Title IX because men don't have a men's leadership program that might allow women to join to study men's leadership. Nothing seems to persuade, you know, the OCR attorneys, and they now cite in their dismissal letters, and even when the university agrees to make some changes, they cite in the dismissal letter that the complainant was unable to provide any names of actual victims and their contact information, the dates that discrimination might have happened. And recently with the Denver OCR, which is clearly of the 12 regional offices, the worst or the most militant in terms of not enforcing Title IX, I said to them that I said, although I am not aware of non-female students who applied and were excluded from this female-only program, I am aware of individuals who are discouraged from applying to these programs because of their obvious ineligibility on the basis of sex and gender identity, because I'm often contacted by students or parents or alumni or faculty who are aware of these discriminatory programs. But now it's like they don't want just the names of actual victims. They want the names of potential victims, because the Denver OCR's response was, if you are aware of non-females who are discouraged from applying to these female-only programs because of their sex, please provide their names, which program, the date that this occurred, and any details you may be aware of regarding the incident no later than within a few days. And of course, there was never any kind of incident that could have a date associated with it. So again, it was just, it's like they won't accept any response other than, I do not know any names of actual victims, as a way then to dismiss the case or give the university, you know, some favoritism in how the case gets resolved. So I guess the bottom line is, it seems like the OCR has always had its thumb on the scale in favor of enabling universities to violate Title IX and allow systemic sexism and female favoritism, as evidenced by the many illegal female-only programs that have existed for 20 or 30 years. But I think that their thumbs on the scale have gotten a lot bigger in the last year, based on what I've been seeing. And that's, as Devin said, despite very strong statements in 2021 from both Education Secretary Cardona and Joe Biden in an executive order, where they both said Title IX protects the civil rights of all students, and all students will be guaranteed an educational environment free from discrimination on the basis of sex. Those statements seem to be contradicted by recent actions of the OCR over the last year. So I'll end there and then ask if anybody has any tips on any violations that you're aware of that would allow me to file additional complaints, or I'd be happy to help anybody who wants to file a complaint on your own. And then also, as Devin said at the beginning, if anybody has any advice for either legal or non-legal strategies to, you know, kind of expose this double standard and challenge Title IX violations and kind of bring greater public attention to this. So I'll end there, Devin, and let you take over.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, for that presentation. That's exactly what we wanted to hear, particularly the tail end of that that presentation regarding what appears to be a new standard at the OCR that perhaps is being fueled by a memo or new policy in the Biden administration. I'll take a second here. We've got a few questions and some comments as well. I'll throw your way, Mark, but I'll start with a question that I have. And I'll also remind the audience that if you have any question or comment, tips, anything like that, that you'd like to share with the group or with Mark and me, just put it in the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. Mark, have you seen any memo? Have you put your hands on any memo or any policy? Has there been any FOIA efforts to try to uncover something like that to coordinate this new standard of review for complaints?
No, I haven't followed that strategy yet, and maybe I could think of that. But it almost was as if some memo went out to the regional offices and shared by the head office or whatever, because it just seemed like starting a year ago, almost all of these complaints or investigations would then be followed up with this request for names of actual victims, and almost the exact same language. So it did seem to be some kind of coordinated effort, but I couldn't really tell for sure if it was like some official policy or just something informal where they just wanted to counteract all of my complaints or just create extra work for me or have one extra reason to give favorable treatment to a university. So I guess that would be something to consider. I don't know how I would do that, but I guess just file a FOIA request and see if I could uncover some systematic effort to do this.
Well, it strikes me as though there might be some people on the call here who would be interested in assisting in efforts to uncover whether or not really what amounts to a barrier to filing complaints. Yeah. actually exists. Let me turn to, I have more questions, more thoughts, but let me turn to some of the thoughts that have been shared in our Q&A section here. Some may or may not relate to your comments, your presentation, Mark. So if you don't have a response to it, that's fine. We'll chew on and maybe get back to the folks who are making the comments and asking the questions. And at the tail end of this program, we will be sharing, I think, Mark, your contact information so folks can continue to have this conversation with you. There's a question about $500 million settlement at the University of Michigan. And just recently, the University of Michigan agreed to settle some sexual harassment claims from athletes, I think, by a sports doctor employed at the university for several decades. The University of Michigan's president and provost, I guess, were both released because of sexual improprieties as well. Does that suggest any sort of systemic sexism at the institution? Does this relate to your comments?
Oh, in terms of University of Michigan? Yeah. Well, you know, there's the whole separate issue and for Title IX laws and enforcement for the, you know, campus sexual assault and sexual harassment. And I haven't really worked in that area at all. I've kind of stayed in the area of single sex or sex specific programs, sex specific, you know, scholarships. So in terms of University of Michigan, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, that goes back to the 1960s and 1970s. I think that lawsuit that just got settled. And then these more recent cases where the provost was fired a couple of years ago and the president was just fired, I think, a week ago. So, again, maybe it's just, you know, they talk about even Schlissel, the president just got fired. He's the one who talked about inappropriate relationships and zero tolerance. And then he was actually doing it himself at the time. So, you know, I guess it does show that, you know, Title IX violations can be taken very seriously, especially, you know, with the $450 million settlement, which I think is what MSU paid, you know, so the consequences can be huge. I would just like to maybe see some of those consequences in the area that I've been working in, which are the sex-specific programs and sex-specific scholarships and so on.
Thanks, Mark. Just a couple of quick answers to questions I saw here. I do believe that the slides that you use, Mark, we can make those available to attendees. There are some folks asking if they can review those slides. And also, yes, this program is being recorded and it will be posted on the Federalist Society website at some later date for other folks who haven't been able to or who couldn't join to watch. There's a question, Mark, and I should have said from the outset that Mark is not a lawyer. And you don't have to be a lawyer to file these complaints. And it's a very good thing that that's the case. Or else Mark's one man wrecking crew here would be in trouble. But there are a few law questions here. There's a question, how often do investigations actually result in litigation through a judgment? Are you aware?
No, because, and I would love to, you know, kind of pursue that approach, but none of these have been, you know, litigation, none of these have been lawsuits, and I'm sure everybody knows that that would require somebody with legal standing. And which is always kind of difficult. Although, I mean, if that's kind of the way to get, you know, more effective kind of resolution of the issue, that, you know, I'd be happy to work on that. It would just be then a matter of having an individual, a male who applied for a female only scholarship or applied to a women only summer program and got rejected. You know, I think the problem with that could be that, you know, the universities are kind of wise enough to know that if they reject that male applicant, that then that could put them in trouble. So they might even say, okay, occasionally accept a male or boy into an all-girl program. But yeah, so I mean, I would be happy to talk with anybody if I can help out on any kind of litigation that maybe would involve a lawsuit or maybe we would need, you know, individuals with legal standing. I'd be happy to pursue that option.
Yeah, let me just reiterate that point, because we've had quite a few questions regarding what sort of court actions have been brought lot in your experience here. I imagine, again, you're not a lawyer, don't necessarily have one on retainer at any given time to help you with these matters, but you certainly would welcome having lawyers who are on this call or others who might have missed this to assist in your efforts through the courts of law.
Yeah, and one example that I didn't mention, but it was at the end of my kind of notes here, is that the Judicial Watch and the Legal Insurrection Foundation just recently, within the last few days, earlier this week, I think, successfully, or the decision was just made, that they successfully challenged a public school scholarship program in Asheville, North Carolina, where they had received some settlement from something else, and they were going to be using it for some scholarship program, but it was only going to be available for Black students. And so that was a legal challenge where I think they may have had some plaintiffs, and then that was ruled in their favor. And so now the program is no longer restricted to Black students. But then again, it's usually, I think they did have plaintiffs. So that was an example. I was encouraged to see that, knowing that there is a legal avenue outside of just what I'm doing, kind of one complaint at a time, that might be more effective, because then it gets greater media attention, and then there's a legal precedent, I guess, and so on.
That goes to a question that I saw here regarding race-based student centers. Are there complaints regarding whether they violate civil rights? You have been involved in filing Title VI complaints as it pertains to racially discriminatory student centers and scholarships and so on and so forth in recent years, correct?
Yes, I have. In fact, you know, in the last year, again, yeah, like you were saying, kind of since George Floyd, when a lot of these programs have been introduced, I have been filing more Title VI complaints. I've just filed two complaints recently versus the University of Minnesota, because they have two racially segregated student housing options on campus. There was a number of George Floyd Memorial scholarships that I challenged. Harvard had a theater performance on campus that was only for a Black attendees that I challenged. As I talked to you earlier off before the program started, Devin, I have an investigation open at American University, which last year introduced a Black only affinity section of a required course that all freshmen or first year students are required to take. And so they are introducing on their schedule for spring, that's just starting now, 5 or 6 out of 100 sections were set aside for only Black students. And the OCR opened an investigation about a week ago, and a couple of days later, those Black affinity sections were removed from the college's website. So I have been targeting more men of color, women of color programs, Black only scholarships, BIPOC only, scholarships or summer programs. And so a lot of my work lately has been in the area of filing Title VI complaints.
Thank you, Mark. We have about 10 minutes left, still quite a few questions and comments. There's a longer one. I'd like to just get through this and see if you have some response, Mark, particularly given your long tenure in academia. Can you comment on the situation in the humanities, where many professional positions are announced with the line that, quote, "The purpose of this position is to enhance racial diversity in the department, in particular, Black presence in the department," end quote. In the same vein, what do you make of the required DEI statements that one is required now to write in the humanities for any professional application, where it is specifically stated that you need to describe your advocacy for DEI and how you're working to create equity? Any thoughts on that in response, Mark?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a terrible development, and I think that's a consequence of universities like Ohio State and University of Michigan having 125 diversocrats who just sit around, I guess, all day and kind of figure out ways that they can stir up trouble or advance their agendas. But I think that, you know, it started in California, it spread throughout the rest of the country, including University of Michigan, where almost every job now requires a diversity statement. And I think there's been some study that in one job opening in for University of California, most of the applications were rejected for not having a strong enough diversity statement. And I think that what's happening now is it's not just to start your career as an assistant professor and get your first year out of grad school. You know, it's not clear if you've been studying chemistry for 5 or 6 years or mathematics, you know, like then what are, and then you're supposed to, tell the university, you know, really, well, I call it a uniformity statement, because you're really supposed to pledge to the university that you're on board with their, you know, narrative about diversity. And then you have to say what you're going to do in your teaching and what you're going to do in your research and what you're going to do in your service to advance the university's goals of diversity, inclusion, and equity. So that's where it starts, is just to get the job. But now I think what's happening is to apply for any type of fellowship or any type of research grant, or to then to get promoted to, you know, associate professor with tenure, or get promoted to full professor, or just even in your annual activity report, you're going to be required now to produce some kind of diversity statement. And it's really just some kind of loyalty oath where you're pledging, you know, allegiance to their holy trinity of diversity, inclusion, and equity. And I think it's just a terrible trend. It's moving away from merit-based hiring. And I don't know, you might have seen Jordan Peterson just resigned yesterday, I think, from the University of Toronto as a tenured full professor, and wrote a very strong statement and talked about how this diversity, inclusion, and equity was kind of poisoning academia, and that he didn't think that as a, you know, supervising doctoral students in psychology, he just was under the assumption now, but, well, the reality that any of his white male students that he that would train under him and study under him would be unable to get jobs in academia or even in industry as a white male. So I think it's just really a dangerous precedent that started and now is spreading throughout all of higher education at all different levels. And so it'll follow a professor around his or her entire career of having to continually produce uniformity statements that you're on board with their commitment to diversity, inclusion, and equity. Very dangerous.
Thanks a lot for that response, Mark. Now, let me just announce that there are quite a few comments being made that are sort of helpful tips, I think, for you to chew on, Mark. What I think we're going to do with all of those comments is just collect them for you and share them with you after this program so that you can follow up at your leisure with some of our attendees based on the comments that are being made. A number of them very, very good comments. There's a question here, I think, pretty quickly dispensed with, but I will put it out there. Is there any way these kinds of civil rights claims can be used against private colleges? You know, private colleges also take federal funds. So at the end of the day, you don't discriminate for the most part in filing your complaints against public or private colleges. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the way the Department of Education operates is that any university that accepts what they call federal financial assistance is required then to enforce Title IX and Title VI. And federal financial assistance includes Pell Grants that universities, of course, use to provide financial aid to students, federally insured student loans, which all universities provide, private and public, and then, of course, then direct research grants. And so I think the only university that's not under Title IX and Title VI in the United States is Hillsdale College in Michigan, which doesn't accept any federal funding and doesn't allow any federally insured student loans. So then they're out of their Title IX obligations, although, I mean, they still have to follow, you know, state civil rights laws and so on. So yeah, so every university is obligated to enforce Title IX and Title VI. I think the one exception is, and they, I think, wrote this into the original law, is that women-only colleges are not, they're exempt from Title IX, that you couldn't challenge the fact that they're only allowing women. And I think that also applies to charter schools, that you can have single-sex charter schools and not violate Title IX.
Okay, terrific. We have about 5 minutes left, Mark. What I want to do right now, so that I can leave a little bit of time here at the tail end so you can give sort of a wrap-up comment, is to provide your contact information. So for individuals who are interested in contacting Mark about any of the things he said today or any other comments that you might have, his email address is M, as in Mark, J, Perry, P-E, R-R-Y at UMich, U-M-I-C-H dot E-D-U. Mark, you're also on Twitter at Mark_J_Harry. Find him there. Any other contact information you'd like to share, Mark?
No, but I would just say, I know I saw in the comments or chat, a few people were interested in the slides. I actually have a longer set of slides that I could provide to people. I just kind of narrowed it down to 4, given in the interest of time and not going beyond 30 minutes. So yeah, and I've actually done a lot of work in this area of gender differences in educational outcomes, especially in U.S. higher education. And so I've done a lot of thinking and analysis on differences, gender differences in outcomes for colleges. I've analyzed, you know, for example, I have the female share of college degrees year to year by the major, degree programs and so on. So somebody wanted the email, I guess, one more time.
Yes. So Mark's email address is M as in Mark, J Perry, P-E-R-R-Y at UMich, U-M-I-C-H dot E-D-U, MJ Perry at UMich dot E-D-U. I'm going to take an opportunity to ask two final questions. And then, Mark, I'm just going to leave it to you to wrap us up with anything that is still on your mind. Two things. One, you mentioned preferred groups, not preferred groups. You make a decent case here that if there should be any sort of preferred groups, and you're not saying that there should be, it might be men. Who should be preferred because they're underrepresented. They have been for decades based on data that you shared with us, but that's not the case. Have you in your experience ever seen any race-specific or gender-specific programs, activities, et cetera, federally funded schools for white male-specific programs or activities? And then secondly, have you seen or experienced any complications with transgender students in your experience? We're talking about this issue as if it's today a binary one. I think it's a little complicated by some transgender issues that we're dealing with today. Have you run into any of that?
Yeah, well, in terms of the, you know, whites only programs, the only one that I can think of right now, and I filed a complaint against it, it's the University of Texas, Austin, came out with a program called Go Car, and the K-A-R is Kids Against Racism. And it's a program, it's a political indoctrination program, in my opinion, for 4- and 5-year-olds, where the University of Texas is promoting this program now. They're looking for 4- and 5-year-old boys and girls and their caregivers. They don't call them parents anymore. They're called caregivers who will participate in this program. And it's an anti-racism program. And when they originally requested the funding, they didn't mention that in the implementation of the program, it was going to be for white kids only and white parents. So now they've introduced the program. They're seeking 4- and 5-year-olds and their caregivers, but it's for whites only. And so I filed a Title VI complaint, you know, alleging race discrimination, that they've got this educational program, but they're not providing it for blacks or Hispanics or Asians, only for whites. So that would be one example of now they're kind of just going in the reverse order and just, you know, targeting whites now for racism. So that's one example. Then with the trans issue, you know, it's really kind of interesting because, you know, according to Facebook and New York City and a lot of other organizations, there's 50 or 60 genders now. And so actually that I think supports my case, because if a university is saying this is for female students only, or female faculty only, or female identifying, then they're excluding not just men, but all of the gender non-binary, gender non-conforming students or faculty who don't identify as male or female. And I think the Biden administration has come out with a new guidance letter or document saying that Title IX protects not just discrimination based on sex, but based on gender identity. So I think in a way, I think that helps me, because the female only programs, then they're discriminating not just against men, but all of the other possible 40 or 50 gender identities that are not female identities. So I think that's a development that can kind of help my case, that really it should be, if it's a scholarship or a program, it should just be open to everybody. You know, regardless of sex or gender or race or color, including transgender, gender non-binary, gender fluid, gender non-conforming, and agender, pangender, and so on.
Well, thank you, Mark. I see that Evelyn now has come back into the screen. I think we have reached the limit of our waxing prolix here about this topic. It's been a lot of fun for me. I really appreciate you taking the time to discuss with us what you've been doing over the last several years. That's been really, really incredible in terms of civil rights advocacy. I want to continue to follow this. I hope that our attendees in the audience will also continue to follow what you're doing. Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah, maybe we can follow up in a year or 2 years and do an update.
That sounds great.
All right.
That would be great. I'm sorry to draw this to a close, but thank you very much to Mark Perry, our speaker this afternoon, to Devin Westhill, our moderator, for an excellent discussion. Thank you to our audience for participating and sending in excellent questions and comments. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. So if you have any comments, please send those to that email address. And without anything further, we are adjourned. Thanks very much, everyone.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.